the Czech affair. There will be war. Our task is to isolate Poland. Success in isolating her will be decisive. So, there will be war. With an isolated Poland alone? Here the Führer is not so clear. In fact, he becomes confused and contradictory. He must reserve to himself, he says, the final order to strike. It must not come to a simultaneous showdown with the West, France and England. If it is not certain that a German-Polish conflict will not lead to war with the West, then the fight must be primarily against England and France. Fundamentally, therefore, conflict with Poland, beginning with an attack on Poland, will only be successful if the West keeps out of it. If that is not possible, it is better to fall upon the West and to finish off Poland at the same time. In the face of such rapid-fire contradictions, the generals must have winced, perhaps prying their monocles loose, though there is no evidence in the Schmundt minutes that this happened or that anyone in the select audience even dared to ask a question to straighten matters out. Hitler next turned to Russia. "It is not ruled out," he said, "that Russia might disinterest herself in the destruction of Poland. On the other hand, if the Soviet Union allied herself to Britain and France, that would lead me to attack England and France with a few devastating blows. That would mean committing the same mistake Wilhelm II made in 1914. But though in this lecture Hitler drew several lessons from the World War, he did not draw this one. His thoughts now turned toward Great Britain. The Führer doubts the possibility of a peaceful settlement with England. It is necessary to be prepared for the showdown. England sees in our development the establishment of a hegemony which would weaken England. Therefore, England is our enemy, and the conflict with England is a matter of life and death. What will this conflict be like? England cannot finish off Germany with a few powerful blows and force us down. It is of decisive importance for England to carry the war as near as possible to the Ruhr. French blood will not be spared. West Wall! The duration of our existence is dependent on possession of the Ruhr. Having decided to follow the Kaiser in one mistake, attacking France and England if they lined up with Russia, Hitler now announced that he would follow the Emperor in another matter which eventually had proved disastrous to Germany. The Dutch and Belgian air bases must be militarily occupied. Declarations of neutrality can be ignored. If England wants to intervene in the Polish War, we must make a lightning attack on Holland. We must aim at establishing a new line of defense on Dutch territory as far as the Zuider Zee. The war with England and France will be a war of life and death. The idea that we can get off cheaply is dangerous. There is no such possibility. We must then burn our boats, and it will no longer be a question of right or wrong, but of to be or not to be for 80 million people. Though he had just announced that Germany would attack Poland at the first suitable opportunity, and though his listeners knew that almost all of Germany's military strength was being concentrated on that objective, Hitler, as he rambled on, could not keep his thoughts off Great Britain. England, he emphasized, is the driving force against Germany, whereupon he discussed her strengths and weaknesses. The Britisher himself is proud, brave, tough, dogged, and a gifted organizer. He knows how to exploit every new development. He has the love of adventure and the courage of the Nordic race. England is a world power in herself, constant for 300 years, increased by alliances. This power is not only something concrete, but must also be considered a psychological force, embracing the entire world. Add to this immeasurable wealth and the solvency that goes with it. Geopolitical security and protection by a strong sea power and courageous air force. But Britain, Hitler reminded his hearers, also had her weaknesses, and he proceeded to enumerate them. If in the last war we had had 2 more battleships and 2 more cruisers, and had begun the Battle of Jutland in the morning, the British fleet would have been defeated and England brought to her knees. Hitler's understanding of the Battle of Jutland was obviously faulty. It would have meant the end of the World War. In former times, to conquer England, it was necessary to invade her. England could feed herself. Today, she no longer can. The moment England is cut off from her supplies, she is forced to capitulate. Imports of food and fuel oil are dependent on naval protection. Luftwaffe attacks on England will not force her to capitulate. But if the fleet is annihilated, instant capitulation results. There is no doubt that a surprise attack might lead to a quick decision. A surprise attack with what? Surely Admiral Raeder must have thought that Hitler was talking through his hat. Under the so-called Z-plan, promulgated at the end of 1938, German naval strength would only begin to approach that of the British by 1945. At the moment, in the spring of 1939, Germany did not have the heavy ships to sink the British Navy, even by a surprise attack. Perhaps Britain could be brought down by other means. Here Hitler came down to earth again and outlined a strategic plan, which a year later, in fact, would be carried out with amazing success. The aim must be to deal the enemy a smashing or a finally decisive blow right at the start. Considerations of right or wrong or of treaties do not enter into the matter. This will be possible only when we do not slide into a war with England on account of Poland. Preparations must be made for a long war as well as for a surprise attack, and every possible intervention by England on the continent must be smashed. The army must occupy the positions important for the fleet and the Luftwaffe. If we succeed in occupying and securing Holland and Belgium, as well as defeating France, the basis for a successful war against England has been created. The Luftwaffe can then closely blockade England from western France, and the fleet undertake the wider blockade with submarines. That is precisely what would be done a little more than a year later. Another decisive strategic plan, which the Führer emphasized on May 23rd, would also be carried out. At the beginning of the last war, had the German army executed a wheeling movement toward the Channel ports instead of toward Paris? The end, he said, would have been different. Perhaps it would have been. At any rate, he would try it in 1940. The aim, Hitler concluded, apparently forgetting all about Poland for the moment, will always be to force England to her knees. There was one final consideration. Secrecy is the decisive prerequisite for success. Our objectives must be kept secret from both Italy and Japan. Even Hitler's own army general staff, whose chief, General Halder, sat there listening, was not to be trusted entirely. Our studies, the Führer laid down, must not be left to the general staff. Secrecy would then no longer be assured. He ordered that a small planning staff in OKW be set up to work out the military plans. On May 23, 1939, then, Hitler, as he himself said, burned his boats. There would be war. Germany needed Lebensraum in the east. To get at Poland would be attacked at the first opportunity. Danzig had nothing to do with it. That was merely an excuse. Britain stood in the way. She was the real driving force against Germany. Very well. She would be taken on, too, and France. It would be a life-and-death struggle. When the Führer had first outlined his plans for aggression to the military chiefs on November 5, 1937, Field Marshal von Blomberg and General von Fritsch had protested, at least on the grounds that Germany was too weak to fight a European war. During the following summer, General Beck had resigned as chief of the Army General Staff for the same reason. But on May 23, 1939, not a single general or admiral, so far as the record shows, raised his voice to question the wisdom of Hitler's course. Their job, as they saw it, was not to question, but to blindly obey. Already they had been applying their considerable talents to working out plans for military aggression. On May 7th, Colonel Günter Blumentritt of the Army General Staff, who with Generals von Rundstedt and von Manstein formed a small working staff, submitted an estimate of the situation for Case White. Actually, it was a plan for the conquest of Poland. It was an imaginative and daring plan, and it would be followed with very few changes. Admiral Raeder came through with naval plans for Case White in a top-secret directive signed May 16th. Since Poland had only a few miles of coast on the Baltic west of Danzig and possessed only a small navy, no difficulties were expected. France and Britain were the admiral's chief concern. The entrance to the Baltic was to be protected by submarines, and the two pocket battleships and the two battleships, with the remaining submarines, were to prepare for war in the Atlantic. According to the instructions of the Führer, the Navy had to be prepared to carry out its part of White by September 1st, but Raeder urged his commanders to hasten plans because Due to the latest political developments, action might come sooner. As May 1939 came to an end, German preparations for going to war by the end of the summer were well along. The great armament works were humming, turning out guns, tanks, planes, and warships. The able staffs of the Army, Navy, and Air Force had reached the final stage of planning. The ranks were being swelled by new men called up for summer training. Hitler could be pleased with what he had accomplished. The day after the Führer's lecture to the military chiefs, on May 24th, General Georg Thomas, head of the Economic and Armaments Branch of OKW, summed up that accomplishment in a confidential lecture to the staff of the Foreign Office. Whereas it had taken the Imperial Army, Thomas reminded his listeners, 16 years, from 1898 to 1914, to increase its strength from 43 to 50 divisions, the Army of the Third Reich had jumped from 7 to 51 divisions in just 4 years. Among them were 5 heavy armored divisions and 4 light ones, a modern battle cavalry such as no other nation possessed. The Navy had built up from practically nothing a fleet of 2 battleships of 26,000 tons, 2 heavy cruisers, 17 destroyers, and 47 submarines. It had already launched 2 battleships of 35,000 tons, 1 aircraft carrier, 4 heavy cruisers, 5 destroyers, and 7 submarines, and was planning to launch a great many more ships. In giving these tonnages for German battleships, General Thomas was deceiving even the Foreign Office. An interesting German naval document dated more than a year before, February 18, 1938, notes that false figures on battleship tonnage had been furnished the British government under the Anglo-German Naval Agreement. It states that the actual tonnage of the 26,000-ton ships was 31,300 tons. That of the 35,000-ton battleships, the top level in the British and American navies, was actually 41,700 tons. It is a curious example of Nazi deceit. From absolutely nothing, the Luftwaffe had built up a force of 21 squadrons with a personnel of 260,000 men. The armament industry, General Thomas said, was already producing more than it had during the peak of the last war, and its output in most fields far exceeded that of any other country. In fact, total German rearmament, the general declared, was probably unique in the world. Formidable as German military power was becoming at the beginning of the summer of 1939, the prospect of success in the war which Hitler was planning for the early fall depended on what kind of war it was. Germany was still not strong enough, and probably would never be, to take on France, Britain, and Russia in addition to Poland. As the fateful summer commenced, all depended on the Führer's ability to limit the war, above all, to keep Russia from forming the military alliance with the West which Litvinov, just before his fall, had proposed, and which Chamberlain, though he had at first seemed to reject it, was, by May's end, again mulling over. The Intervention of Russia. 2. In a debate in the House of Commons on May 19th, the British Prime Minister had again taken a cool and even disdainful view, as Churchill thought, of the Russian proposals. Somewhat wearily, he had explained to the House that there is a sort of veil, a sort of wall between the two governments, which it is extremely difficult to penetrate. Churchill, on the other hand, backed by Lloyd George, argued that Moscow had made a fair offer, more simple, more direct, more effective than Chamberlain's own proposals. He begged His Majesty's government to get some brutal truths into their heads. Without an effective Eastern Front, there can be no satisfactory defense in the West, and without Russia, there can be no effective Eastern Front. Bowing to the storm of criticism from all sides, Chamberlain, on May 27th, finally instructed the British ambassador in Moscow to agree to begin discussions of a pact of mutual assistance, a military convention, and guarantees to the countries threatened by Hitler. On May 27th, the British ambassador and the French chargé d'affaires in Moscow presented Molotov with an Anglo-French draft of the proposed pact. To the surprise of the Western envoys, Molotov took a very cool view of it. Ambassador von Dirksen in London advised the German Foreign Office that the British government had taken the step with the greatest reluctance. Furthermore, Dirksen divulged what was perhaps the primary reason for Chamberlain's move. The British Foreign Office, he reported urgently to Berlin, had got wind of German feelers in Moscow, and was afraid that Germany might succeed in keeping Soviet Russia neutral, or even inducing her to adopt benevolent neutrality. That would have meant the complete collapse of the encirclement action. On the last day of May, Molotov made his first public speech as Commissar for Foreign Affairs in an address to the Supreme Council of the USSR. He castigated the Western democracies for their hesitation and declared that if they were serious in joining Russia to stop aggression, they must get down to brass tacks and come to an agreement on three main points. 1. Conclude a tripartite mutual assistance pact of a purely defensive character. 2. Guarantee the states of Central and Eastern Europe, including all European states bordering on the Soviet Union. 3. Conclude a definite agreement on the form and scope of the immediate and effective aid to be afforded each other and the smaller states threatened by aggression. Molotov also declared that the talks with the West did not mean that Russia would forego business relations on a practical footing with Germany and Italy. In fact, he said that it was not out of the question that commercial negotiations with Germany could be resumed. Ambassador von der Schulenburg, in reporting the speech to Berlin, pointed out that Molotov had indicated that Russia was still prepared to conclude a treaty with Britain and France on condition that all her demands are accepted, but that it was now evident from the address that it would take a long time before any real agreement was reached. He pointed out that Molotov had avoided sallies against Germany and showed readiness to continue the talks begun in Berlin and Moscow. This readiness was now suddenly shared by Hitler in Berlin. During the last 10 days of May, Hitler and his advisers blew hot and cold over the thorny question of making advances to Moscow in order to thwart the Anglo-Russian negotiations. It was felt in Berlin that Molotov, in his talk with Ambassador von der Schulenburg on May 20th, had thrown cold water on Germany's approaches. And on the following day, May 21st, Weizsäcker wired the ambassador that in view of what the foreign commissar had said, we must now sit tight and wait to see if the Russians will speak more openly. But Hitler, having fixed September 1st for his attack on Poland, could not afford to sit tight. On or about May 25th, Weizsäcker and Friedrich Gauss, director of the legal department of the German Foreign Office, were summoned to Ribbentrop's country house at Sonnenburg, and, according to Gauss's affidavit submitted at Nuremberg, informed that the Führer wanted to establish more tolerable relations between Germany and the Soviet Union. The affidavit was rejected as evidence by the tribunal and is not published in the Nazi Conspiracy and Aggression, or Trial of the Major War Criminals volumes of the Nuremberg Evidence. This does not detract from its authenticity. All material dealing with Nazi-Soviet collaboration during this period was handled gingerly by the tribunal, one of whose 4 judges was a Russian. Draft instructions to Schulenburg were drawn up by Ribbentrop, outlining in considerable detail the new line he was to take with Molotov, whom he was asked to see as soon as possible. This draft is among the captured German Foreign Office documents. It was shown to Hitler, according to a notation on the document, on May 26th. It is a revealing paper. It discloses that by this date the German Foreign Office was convinced that the Anglo-Russian negotiations would be successfully concluded unless Germany intervened decisively. Ribbentrop therefore proposed that Schulenburg tell Molotov the following. A real opposition of interests in foreign affairs does not exist between Germany and Soviet Russia. The time has come to consider a pacification and normalization of German-Soviet-Russian foreign relations. The Italo-German alliance is not directed against the Soviet Union. It is exclusively directed against the Anglo-French combination. If, against our wishes, it should come to hostilities with Poland, we are firmly convinced that even this need not in any way lead to a clash of interests with Soviet Russia. We can even go so far as to say that when settling the German-Polish question, in whatever way this is done, we would take Russian interests into account as far as possible. Next, the danger to Russia of an alliance with Great Britain was to be pointed up. We are unable to see what could really induce the Soviet Union to play an active part in the game of the British policy of encirclement. This would mean Russia undertaking a one-sided liability without any really valuable British quid pro quo. Britain is by no means in a position to offer Russia a really valuable quid pro quo, no matter how the treaties may be formulated. All assistance in Europe is rendered impossible by the West Wall. We are therefore convinced that Britain will once more remain faithful to her traditional policy of letting other powers pull her chestnuts out of the fire. Schulenburg also was to emphasize that Germany had no aggressive intentions against Russia. Finally, he was instructed to tell Molotov that Germany was ready to discuss with the Soviet Union not only economic questions, but a return to normal in political relations. Hitler thought the draft went too far and ordered it held up. The Führer, according to Gauss, had been impressed by Chamberlain's optimistic statement of 2 days before, May 24th, when the Prime Minister had told the House of Commons that as the result of new British proposals he hoped that full agreement with Russia could be reached at an early date. What Hitler feared was a rebuff. He did not abandon the idea of a rapprochement with Moscow, but decided that for the time being a more cautious approach would be best. The backing and filling which took place in the Führer's mind during the last week of May is documented in the captured German Foreign Office papers. On or about the 25th, the exact day is not quite certain, he had suddenly come out for pushing talks with the Soviet Union in order to thwart the Anglo-Russian negotiations. Schulenburg was to see Molotov at once for that purpose. But Ribbentrop's instructions to him, which were shown Hitler on the 26th, were never sent. The Führer cancelled them. That evening, Weizsäcker wired Schulenburg advising him to maintain an attitude of complete reserve. You personally should not make any move until further notice. This telegram and a letter which the State Secretary wrote the ambassador in Moscow on May 27th but did not mail until May 30th, when a significant postscript was added, go far to explaining the hesitations in Berlin. Weizsäcker, writing on the 27th, informed Schulenburg that it was the opinion in Berlin that an Anglo-Russian agreement would not be easy to prevent, and that Germany hesitated to intervene decisively against it for fear of provoking a peal of Tartar laughter in Moscow. Also, the State Secretary revealed, both Japan and Italy had been cool toward Germany's proposed move in Moscow, and the reserve of her allies had helped to influence the decision in Berlin to sit tight. Thus, he concluded, we now want to wait and see how deeply Moscow and Paris-London mutually engage themselves. For some reason, Weizsäcker did not post his letter at once. Perhaps he felt that Hitler had not yet fully made up his mind. When he did mail it on May 30th, he added a postscript. P.S. To my above lines, I must add that, with the approval of the Führer, an approach is nonetheless now to be made to the Russians, though a very much modified one, and this by means of a conversation which I am to hold today with the Russian chargé d'affaires. This talk with Georgi Astakov did not get very far, but it represented for the Germans a new start. Weizsäcker's pretext for calling in the Russian chargé was to discuss the future of the Soviet trade delegation in Prague, which the Russians were anxious to maintain. Around this subject, the two diplomats sparred to find out what was in each other's mind. Weizsäcker said he agreed with Molotov that political and economic questions could not be entirely separated, and expressed interest in the normalization of relations between Soviet Russia and Germany. Astakov asserted that Molotov had no intention of barring the door against further Russo-German discussions. Cautious as both men were, the Germans were encouraged. At 10:40 o'clock that evening of May 30th, Weizsäcker got off a most urgent telegram to Schulenburg in Moscow. Contrary to the tactics hitherto planned, we have now, after all, decided to make a certain degree of contact with the Soviet Union. In Nazi-Soviet Relations, a volume of German Foreign Office documents on that subject published by the U.S. State Department in 1949, the English translation of the telegram came out much stronger. The key sentence was given as, "We have now decided to undertake definite negotiations with the Soviet Union." This has led many historians, including Churchill, to conclude that this telegram of May 30th marked the decisive turning point in Hitler's efforts to make a deal with Moscow. That turning point came later. As Weizsäcker pointed out in the May 30th postscript to his letter to Schulenburg, the German approach, which Hitler had approved, was to be a very much modified one. It may have been that a long secret memorandum which Mussolini penned to Hitler on May 30th strengthened the Führer's resolve to turn to the Soviet Union, however cautiously. As the summer commenced, the Duce's doubts mounted as to the advisability of an early conflict. He was convinced, he wrote Hitler, that war between the plutocratic self-seeking conservative nations and the Axis was inevitable. But Italy requires a period of preparation which may extend until the end of 1942. Only from 1943 onward will an effort by war have the greatest prospects of success. After enumerating several reasons why Italy needs a period of peace, the Duce concluded, "For all these reasons, Italy does not wish to hasten a European war, although she is convinced of the inevitability of such a war." Hitler, who had not taken his good friend and ally into his confidence about the date of September 1st, which he had set for attacking Poland, replied that he had read the secret memorandum with the greatest interest, and suggested that the two leaders meet for discussions sometime in the future. In the meantime, the Führer decided to see if a crack could be made in the Kremlin wall. All through June, preliminary talks concerning a new trade agreement were held in Moscow between the German embassy and Anastas Mikoyan, the Russian commissar for foreign trade. The Soviet government was still highly suspicious of Berlin. As Schulenburg reported toward the end of the month, June 27th, the Kremlin believed the Germans, in pressing for a trade agreement, wished to torpedo the Russian negotiations with Britain and France. "They are afraid," he wired Berlin, "that as soon as we have gained this advantage, we might let the negotiations peter out." On June 28th, Schulenburg had a long talk with Molotov, which proceeded, he told Berlin in a secret and urgent telegram, "in a friendly manner." Nevertheless, when the German ambassador referred assuringly to the non-aggression treaties which Germany had just concluded with the Baltic states, the Soviet foreign commissar tartly replied that he must doubt the permanence of such treaties after the experiences which Poland had had. To try to forestall an Anglo-French-Russian guarantee of Latvia and Estonia, which bordered on the Soviet Union, Germany had hastily signed non-aggression pacts with these two Baltic states on June 7th. Even before this, on May 31st, Germany had pushed through a similar pact with Denmark, which, considering recent events, appears to have given the Danes an astonishing sense of security. Summing up the talk, Schulenburg concluded, "My impression is that the Soviet government is greatly interested in learning our political views and in maintaining contact with us." Although there was no mistaking the strong distrust evident in all that Molotov said, he nevertheless described a normalization of relations with Germany as being desirable and possible. The ambassador requested telegraphic instructions as to his next move. Schulenburg was one of the last survivors of the Zeigt, Maltzahn, and Brockdorff-Rantzau school, which had insisted on a German rapprochement with Soviet Russia after 1919, and which had brought it about at Rapallo. As his dispatches throughout 1939 make clear, he sincerely sought to restore the close relations which had existed during the Weimar Republic. But like so many other German career diplomats of the old school, he little understood Hitler. Suddenly, on June 29th, Hitler, from his mountain retreat at Berchtesgaden, ordered the talks with the Russians broken off. Berchtesgaden, June 29th, 1939. The Führer has decided as follows. The Russians are to be informed that we have seen from their attitude that they are making the continuation of further talks dependent on the acceptance of the basis for our economic discussions as fixed in January. Since this basis was not acceptable to us, we would not be interested in a resumption of the economic discussions with Russia at present. The Führer has agreed that this answer be delayed for a few days. Actually, the substance of it was telegraphed to the German embassy in Moscow the next day. The foreign minister, Weizsäcker wired, is of the opinion that in the political field enough has been said until further instructions, and that for the moment the talks should not be taken up again by us. Concerning the possible economic negotiations with the Russian government, the deliberations here have not yet been concluded. In this field, too, you are requested for the time being to take no further action, but to await instructions. There is no clue in the secret German documents which explains Hitler's sudden change of mind. The Russians already had begun to compromise on their proposals of January and February, and Schnurre had warned on June 15th that a breakdown in the economic negotiations would be a setback for Germany both economically and politically. Nor could the rocky course of the Anglo-French-Soviet negotiations have so discouraged Hitler as to lead him to such a decision. He knew from the reports of the German embassy in Moscow that Russia and the Western powers were deadlocked over the question of guarantees to Poland, Romania, and the Baltic states. Poland and Romania were happy to be guaranteed by Britain and France, which could scarcely help them in the event of German aggression except by the indirect means of setting up a Western front. But they refused to accept a Russian guarantee or even to allow for Soviet troops to pass through their territories to meet a German attack. Latvia, Estonia, and Finland also stoutly declined to accept any Russian guarantee, an attitude which, as the German Foreign Office papers later revealed, was encouraged by Germany in the form of dire threats should they weaken in their resolve. In this impasse, Molotov suggested at the beginning of June that Great Britain send its foreign secretary to Moscow to take part in the negotiations. Apparently, in the Russian view, this would not only help to break the deadlock, but would show that Britain was in earnest in arriving at an agreement with Russia. Lord Halifax declined to go. According to the British Foreign Office papers, Halifax told Maisky on June 8 that he had thought of suggesting to the Prime Minister that he should go to Moscow, but it was really impossible to get away. Maisky, on June 12, after Strang had left, suggested to Halifax that it would be a good idea for the Foreign Secretary to go to Moscow when things were quieter, but Halifax again stressed the impossibility of his being absent from London for the present. Anthony Eden, who was at least a former foreign secretary, offered to go in his place, but Chamberlain turned him down. It was decided instead to send William Strang, a capable career official in the Foreign Office who had previously served in the Moscow embassy and spoke Russian, but was little known either in his own country or outside of it. The appointment of so subordinate an official to head such an important mission and to negotiate directly with Molotov and Stalin was a signal to the Russians, they later said, that Chamberlain still did not take very seriously the business of building an alliance to stop Hitler. Strang arrived in Moscow on June 14th, but though he participated in 11 Anglo-French meetings with Molotov, his appearance had little effect on the course of Anglo-Soviet negotiations. A fortnight later, on June 29th, Russian suspicion and irritation was publicly displayed in an article in Pravda by Andrei Zhdanov under the headline, "British and French Governments Do Not Want a Treaty on the Basis of Equality for the Soviet Union." Though purporting to write as a private individual and not committing the Soviet government, Zhdanov was not only a member of the Politburo and president of the Foreign Affairs Committee of the Soviet Parliament, but, as Schulenberg emphasized to Berlin in reporting on the matter, one of Stalin's confidants, whose article was doubtless written on orders from above. "It seems to me," Zhdanov wrote, "that the British and French governments are not out for a real agreement acceptable to the USSR, but only for talks about an agreement in order to demonstrate before the public opinion of their own countries the alleged unyielding attitude of the USSR, and thus facilitate the conclusion of an agreement with the aggressors. The next few days will show whether this is so or not." Stalin's distrust of Britain and France and his suspicion that the Western Allies might in the end make a deal with Hitler, as they had the year before at Munich, was thus publicized for all the world to ponder. Ambassador von der Schulenburg, pondering it, suggested to Berlin that one purpose of the article was to lay the blame on Britain and France for the possible breakdown of negotiations. Plans for total war. Still, Adolf Hitler did not rise to the Russian bait. Perhaps it was because all during June he was busy at Berchtesgaden supervising the completion of military plans to invade Poland at the summer's end. By June 15th, he had General von Brauchitsch's top-secret plan for the operations of the army against Poland. "The object of the operation," the commander-in-chief of the army, echoing his master, declared, "is to destroy the Polish armed forces. The political leadership demands that the war should be begun by heavy surprise blows and lead to quick successes. The intention of the Army High Command is to prevent a regular mobilization and concentration of the Polish army by a surprise invasion of Polish territory, and to destroy the mass of the Polish army, which is expected to be west of the Vistula-Narew line, by a concentrated attack from Silesia on the one side and from Pomerania, East Prussia, on the other." To carry out his plan, Brauchitsch set up two army groups, Army Group South, consisting of the 8th, 10th, and 14th Armies, and Army Group North, made up of the 3rd and 4th Armies. The Southern Army Group, under the command of General von Rundstedt, was to attack from Silesia in the general direction of Warsaw, scatter opposing Polish forces, and occupy as early as possible, with forces as strong as possible, the Vistula on both sides of Warsaw, with the aim of destroying the Polish forces still holding out in western Poland in cooperation with Army Group North. The first mission of the latter group was to establish connection between the Reich and East Prussia by driving across the corridor. Detailed objectives for the various armies were outlined, as well as those for the Air Force and Navy. Danzig, said Brauchitsch, would be declared German territory on the first day of hostilities and would be secured by local forces under German command. A supplemental directive issued at the same time stipulated that the order of deployment for White would be put into operation on August 20th. All preparations, it laid down, must be concluded by that date. A week later, on June 22nd, General Keitel submitted to Hitler a preliminary timetable for Case White. The Führer, after studying it, agreed with it in the main, but ordered that, so as not to disquiet the population by calling up reserves on a larger scale than usual, civilian establishments, employers, or other private persons who make inquiries should be told that men are being called up for the autumn maneuvers. Also, Hitler stipulated that, for reasons of security, the clearing of hospitals in the frontier area which the Supreme Command of the Army proposed should take place from the middle of July must not be carried out. The war which Hitler was planning to launch would be total war, and would require not only military mobilization, but a total mobilization of all the resources of the nation. To coordinate this immense effort, a meeting of the Reich Defense Council was convoked the next day, on June 23rd, under the chairmanship of Göring. Some 35 ranking officials, civil and military, including Keitel, Raeder, Halder, Thomas, and Milk, for the armed forces, and the ministers of the Interior, Economics, Finance, and Transport, as well as Himmler, were present. It was only the second meeting of the Council, but, as Göring explained, the body was convoked only to make the most important decisions, and he left no doubt in the minds of his hearers, as the captured secret minutes of the session reveal, that war was near, and that much remained to be done about manpower for industry and agriculture, and about many other matters relating to total mobilization. Göring informed the Council that Hitler had decided to draft some 7 million men. To augment the labor supply, Dr. Funk, the Minister of Economics, was to arrange what work is to be given to prisoners of war and to the inmates of prisons and concentration camps. Himmler chimed in to say that greater use will be made of the concentration camps in wartime. And Göring added that hundreds of thousands of workers from the Czech Protectorate are to be employed under supervision in Germany, particularly in agriculture, and housed in hutments. Already it was obvious the Nazi program for slave labor was taking shape. Dr. Frick, the Minister of the Interior, promised to save labor in the public administration and enlivened the proceedings by admitting that under the Nazi regime the number of bureaucrats increased from 20 to 40-fold, an impossible state of affairs. A committee was set up to correct this lamentable situation. An even more pessimistic report was made by Colonel Rudolf Gerke, chief of the Transport Department of the Army General Staff. In the transportation sphere, he declared bluntly, Germany is at the moment not ready for war. Whether the German transportation facilities would be equal to their task depended, of course, on whether the war was confined to Poland. If it had to be fought in the West against France and Great Britain, it was feared that the transport system would simply not be adequate. In July, two emergency meetings of the Defense Council were called in order to bring the West Wall, by August 25th at the latest, into the optimum condition of preparedness with the material that can be obtained by that time by an extreme effort. High officials of Krupp and the Steel Cartel were enlisted to try to scrape up the necessary metal to complete the armament of the Western fortifications. For on their impregnancy, the Germans knew, depended whether the Anglo-French armies would be inclined to mount a serious attack on Western Germany while the Wehrmacht was preoccupied in Poland. Though Hitler, with unusual frankness, had told his generals on May 23rd that Danzig was not the cause of the dispute with Poland at all, it seemed for a few weeks at midsummer that the Free City might be the powder keg which any day would set off the explosion of war. For some time the Germans had been smuggling into Danzig arms and regular army officers to train the local defense guard in their use. On June 19th, the high command of the army had informed the Foreign Office that 168 German army officers have been granted permission to travel through the Free State of Danzig in civilian clothes on a tour for study purposes. Early in July, General Keitel inquired of the Foreign Office whether it is politically advisable to show in public the 12 light and 4 heavy guns which are in Danzig and to let exercises be carried out with them, or whether it is better to conceal the presence of these guns. How the Germans succeeded in smuggling in heavy artillery past the Polish inspectors is not revealed in the German papers. The arms and officers came in across the border from East Prussia, and in order to keep closer watch on them, the Poles increased the number of their customs officials and frontier guards. The local Danzig authorities, now operating exclusively on orders from Berlin, countered by trying to prevent the Polish officials from carrying out their duties. The conflict reached a crisis on August 4th, when the Polish diplomatic representative in Danzig informed the local authorities that the Polish customs inspectors had been given orders to carry out their functions with arms, and that any attempt by the Danzigers to hamper them would be regarded as an act of violence against Polish officials, and that in such a case the Polish government would retaliate without delay against the Free City. This was a further sign to Hitler that the Poles could not be intimidated, and it was reinforced by the opinion of the German ambassador in Warsaw, who on July 6th telegraphed Berlin that there was hardly any doubt that Poland would fight if there was a clear violation of her rights in Danzig. We know from a marginal note on the telegram in Ribbentrop's handwriting that it was shown the Führer. Hitler was furious. The next day, August 7th, he summoned Albert Forster, the Nazi Gauleiter of Danzig, to Berchtesgaden and told him that he had reached the extreme limit of his patience with the Poles. Angry notes were exchanged between Berlin and Warsaw, so violent in tone that neither side dared to make them public. On the 9th, the Reich government warned Poland that a repetition of its ultimatum to Danzig would lead to an aggravation of German-Polish relations, for which the German government must disclaim all responsibility. The next day, the Polish government replied tartly that they will continue to react as hitherto to any attempt by the authorities of the Free City to impair the rights and interests which Poland enjoys in Danzig, and will do so by such means and measures as they alone may deem appropriate, and that they will regard any intervention by the Reich government as an act of aggression. No small nation which stood in Hitler's way had ever used such language. When on the following day, August 11th, the Führer received Karl Burkhardt, a Swiss who was the League of Nations High Commissioner at Danzig, and who had gone more than halfway to meet the German demands there, he was in an ugly mood. He told his visitor that if the slightest thing was attempted by the Poles, he would fall upon them like lightning with all the powerful arms at his disposal, of which the Poles had not the slightest idea. Monsieur Burkhardt said, the High Commissioner later reported, that that would lead to a general conflict. Herr Hitler replied that if he had to make war, he would rather do it today than tomorrow, that he would not conduct it like the Germany of Wilhelm II, who had always had scruples about the full use of every weapon, and that he would fight without mercy up to the extreme limit. Against whom? Against Poland, certainly. Against Britain and France, if necessary. Against Russia, too. With regard to the Soviet Union, Hitler had finally made up his mind. The Intervention of Russia. 3. A fresh initiative had come from the Russians. On July 18th, E. Babarian, the Soviet trade representative in Berlin, accompanied by two aides, called on Julius Schnurre at the German Foreign Office and informed him that Russia would like to extend and intensify German-Soviet economic relations. He brought along a detailed memorandum for a trade agreement calling for a greatly increased exchange of goods between the two countries, and declared that if a few differences between the two parties were clarified, he was empowered to sign a trade treaty in Berlin. The Germans, as Dr. Schnurre's confidential memorandum of the meeting shows, were rather pleased. Such a treaty, Schnurre noted, will not fail to have its effect at least in Poland and Britain. 4 days later, on July 22nd, the Russian press announced in Moscow that Soviet-German trade negotiations had been resumed in Berlin. On the same day, Weizsäcker rather exuberantly wired Ambassador von der Schulenburg in Moscow some interesting new instructions. As to the trade negotiations, he informed the ambassador, "We will act here in a markedly forthcoming manner, since a conclusion, and this at the earliest possible moment, is desired here for general reasons. As far as the purely political aspect of our conversations with the Russians is concerned," he added, "we regard the period of waiting stipulated for you in our telegram, of June 30th, as having expired. You are therefore empowered to pick up the threads again there, without in any way pressing the matter." They were, in fact, picked up 4 days later, on July 26th, in Berlin. Dr. Schnurre was instructed by Ribbentrop to dine Astakov, the Soviet chargé, and Babarian at a swank Berlin restaurant and sound them out. The two Russians needed little sounding. As Schnurre noted in his confidential memorandum of the meeting, the Russians stayed until about 12:30 a.m. and talked in a very lively and interested manner about the political and economic problems of interest to us. Astakov, with the warm approval of Babarian, declared that a Soviet-German political rapprochement corresponded to the vital interests of the two countries. In Moscow, he said, they had never quite understood why Nazi Germany had been so antagonistic to the Soviet Union. The German diplomat, in response, explained that German policy in the East had now taken an entirely different course. "On our part, there could be no question of menacing the Soviet Union. Our aims were in an entirely different direction. German policy was aimed at Britain. I could imagine a far-reaching arrangement of mutual interests with due consideration for vital Russian problems. However, this possibility would be barred the moment the Soviet Union aligned itself with Britain against Germany. The time for an understanding between Germany and the Soviet Union was opportune now, but would no longer be so after the conclusion of a pact with London. What could Britain offer Russia? At best, participation in a European war and the hostility of Germany. What could we offer against this? Neutrality and keeping out of a possible European conflict, and, if Moscow wished, a German-Russian understanding on mutual interests, which, just as in former times, would work out to the advantage of both countries. Controversial problems between Germany and Russia did not, in my opinion, exist anywhere along the line from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea and to the Far East. In addition, despite all the divergences in their views of life, there was one thing common to the ideology of Germany, Italy, and the Soviet Union: opposition to the capitalist democracies in the West. Thus, in the late evening hours of July 26th, in a small Berlin restaurant over good food and wine partaken by second-string diplomats, was Germany's first serious bid for a deal with Soviet Russia made. The new line which Schnurre took had been given him by Ribbentrop himself. Astakov was pleased to hear it. He promised Schnurre that he would report it at once to Moscow. In the Wilhelmstrasse, the Germans waited impatiently to see what the reaction in the Soviet capital would be. 3 days later, on July 29th, Weizsäcker sent a secret dispatch by courier to Schulenburg in Moscow. "It would be important for us to know whether the remarks made to Astakov and Babarian have met with any response in Moscow. If you see an opportunity of arranging a further conversation with Molotov, please sound him out on the same lines. If this results in Molotov abandoning the reserve he has so far maintained, you could go a step further. This applies in particular to the Polish problem. We would be prepared, however the Polish problem may develop, to safeguard all Soviet interests and to come to an understanding with the government in Moscow. In the Baltic question, too, if the talks took a positive course, the idea could be advanced of so adjusting our attitude to the Baltic states as to respect vital Soviet interests in the Baltic Sea." 2 days later, on July 31st, the State Secretary wired Schulenburg, "Urgent and secret. With reference to our dispatch of July 29th arriving in Moscow by courier today, please report by telegram the date and time of your next interview with Molotov as soon as it is fixed. We are anxious for an early interview." For the first time, a note of urgency crept into the dispatches from Berlin to Moscow. There was good reason for Berlin's sense of urgency. On July 23rd, France and Britain had finally agreed to Russia's proposal that military staff talks be held at once to draw up a military convention which would spell out specifically how Hitler's armies were to be met by the three nations. Although Chamberlain did not announce this agreement until July 31st, when he made it to the House of Commons, the Germans got wind of it earlier. On July 28th, Ambassador von Feldschäck in Paris wired Berlin that he had learned from an unusually well-informed source that France and Britain were dispatching military missions to Moscow, and that the French group would be headed by General Dumont, whom he described as being a particularly capable officer and a former deputy chief of staff under General Maxime Weygand. It was the German ambassador's impression, as he stated in a supplementary dispatch 2 days later, that Paris and London had agreed to military staff talks as a last means of preventing the adjournment of the Moscow negotiations. It was a well-founded impression. As the confidential British Foreign Office papers make clear, the political talks in Moscow had reached an impasse by the last week in July, largely over the impossibility of reaching a definition of indirect aggression. To the British and French, the Russian interpretation of that term was so broad that it might be used to justify Soviet intervention in Finland and the Baltic states, even if there were no serious Nazi threat. And to this, London, at least, the French were prepared to be more accommodating, would not agree. Also, on June 2nd, the Russians had insisted that a military agreement setting down in detail the methods, form, and extent of the military help which the three countries were to give each other should come into force at the same time as the Mutual Assistance Pact itself. The Western powers, which did not think highly of Russia's military prowess, tried to put Molotov off. The British High Command, like the German later, grossly underestimated the potential strength of the Red Army. This may have been due in large part to the reports it received from its military attachés in Moscow. On March 6th, for instance, Colonel Firebrace, the military attaché, and Wing Commander Halliwell, the air attaché, had filed long reports to London to the effect that while the defensive capabilities of the Red Army and Air Force were considerable, they were incapable of mounting a serious offensive. Halliwell thought that the Russian Air Force, like the Army, is likely to be brought to a standstill as much by the collapse of essential services as by enemy action. Firebrace found that the purge of higher officers had severely weakened the Red Army. But he did point out to London that the Red Army considers war inevitable and is undoubtedly being strenuously prepared for it. They would only agree to starting staff talks after the political agreement had been signed. But the Russians were adamant. When the British tried to strike a bargain, offering on July 17th to begin staff conversations at once if the Soviet Union would yield on its insistence on signing political and military agreements simultaneously, and also, for good measure, accept the British definition of indirect aggression, Molotov answered with a blunt rejection. Unless the French and British agreed to political and military agreements in one package, he said, there was no point in continuing the negotiations. This Russian threat to end the talks caused consternation in Paris, which seems to have been more acutely aware than London of the course of Soviet-Nazi flirtations, and it was largely due to French pressure that the British government on August 23rd, while refusing to accept the Russian proposals on indirect aggression, reluctantly agreed to negotiate a military convention. Chamberlain was less than lukewarm to the whole business of staff talks. Strang, negotiating with Molotov in Moscow, was even cooler. "It is indeed extraordinary," he wrote the Foreign Office on July 20th, "that we should be expected to talk military secrets with the Soviet government before we are sure that they will be our allies." The Russian view was just the opposite, and was put by Molotov to the Anglo-French negotiators on July 27th. The important point was to see how many divisions each party would contribute to the common cause, and where they would be located. Before the Russians committed themselves politically, they wanted to know how much military help they could expect from the West. On August 1st, Ambassador von Dirksen in London informed Berlin that the military negotiations with the Russians were regarded skeptically in British government circles. "This is borne out," he wrote, "by the composition of the British military mission. The British mission consisted of Admiral Sir Reginald Plunkett, Colonel Earl Drax, who had been Commander-in-Chief, Plymouth, 1935 to 1938, Air Marshal Sir Charles Burnett, and Major General Haywood. The admiral is practically on the retired list and was never on the naval staff. The general is also purely a combat officer. The air marshal is outstanding as a pilot and an instructor, but not as a strategist. This seems to indicate that the task of the military mission is rather to ascertain the fighting value of the Soviet forces than to conclude agreements on operations. The Wehrmacht attachés are agreed in observing a surprising skepticism in British military circles about the forthcoming talks with the Soviet armed forces. Indeed, so skeptical was the British government that it neglected to give Admiral Drax written authority to negotiate, an oversight, if it was that, which Marshal Voroshilov complained about when the staff officers first met. The admiral's credentials did not arrive until August 21st, when they were no longer of use. But if Admiral Drax had no written credentials, he certainly had secret written instructions as to the course he was to take in the military talks in Moscow. As the British Foreign Office papers much later revealed, the admiral was admonished to go very slowly with the military conversations, watching the progress of the political negotiations until a political agreement had been concluded. It was explained to him that confidential military information could not be imparted to the Russians until the political pact was signed. But since the political conversations had been suspended on August 2nd, and Molotov had made it clear that he would not assent to their being renewed until the military talks had made some progress, the conclusion can scarcely be escaped that the Chamberlain government was quite prepared to take its time in spelling out the military obligations of each country in the proposed mutual assistance pact. A conclusion reached by Arnold Toynbee and his collaborators in their book The Eve of War, 1939, based largely on the British Foreign Office documents. In fact, the confidential British Foreign Office documents leave little doubt that by the beginning of August, Chamberlain and Halifax had almost given up hope of reaching an agreement with the Soviet Union to stop Hitler, but thought that if they stretched out the staff negotiations in Moscow, this might somehow deter the German dictator from taking, during the next 4 weeks, the fatal step toward war. On August 16th, Air Marshal Sir Charles Burnett wrote to London from Moscow, "I understand it is the government's policy to prolong negotiations as long as possible, if we cannot get acceptance of a treaty." Seeds, the British ambassador in Moscow, had wired London on July 24th, the day after his government agreed to staff talks, "I am not optimistic as to the success of military conversations, nor do I think they can in any case be rapidly concluded. But to begin with them now would give a healthy shock to the Axis powers and a fillip to our friends, while they might be prolonged sufficiently to tide over the next dangerous few months." In view of what Anglo-French intelligence knew of the meetings of Molotov with the German ambassador, of German efforts to interest Russia in a new partition of Poland, which Coulondre had warned Paris of as early as May 7th, of massive German troop concentrations on the Polish border, and of Hitler's intentions, this British trust in stalling in Moscow is somewhat startling. In contrast to the British and French, the Russians placed on their military mission the highest officers of their armed forces. Marshal Voroshilov, who was Commissar for Defense, General Shaposhnikov, Chief of the General Staff of the Red Army, and the Commanders-in-Chief of the Navy and Air Force. The Russians could not help noting that whereas the British had sent the Chief of the Imperial General Staff, General Sir Edmund Ironside, to Warsaw in July for military talks with the Polish General Staff, they did not consider sending this ranking British officer to Moscow. It cannot be said that the Anglo-French military missions were exactly rushed to Moscow. A plane would have got them there in a day, but they were sent on a slow boat, a passenger cargo vessel, which took as long to get them to Russia as the Queen Mary could have conveyed them to America. They sailed for Leningrad on August 5th and did not arrive in Moscow until August 11th. By that time, it was too late. Hitler had beaten them to it. While the British and French military officers were waiting for their slow boat to Leningrad, the Germans were acting swiftly. August 3rd was a crucial day in Berlin and Moscow. At 12:58 p.m. on that day, Foreign Minister von Ribbentrop, who invariably left the sending of telegrams to State Secretary von Weizsäcker, got off on his own a wire marked "secret, most urgent" to Schulenburg in Moscow. Yesterday I had a lengthy conversation with Ostakov, on which a telegram follows. I expressed the German wish for remolding German-Russian relations, and stated that from the Baltic to the Black Sea there was no problem which could not be solved to our mutual satisfaction. In response to Ostakov's desire for more concrete conversations on topical questions, I declared myself ready for such conversations if the Soviet government would inform me through Ostakov that they also desired to place